For members only, Golf Smarter number 377, published on March 26, 2013.
SmarterPodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.
Eliminate misreading the green's brake direction. More on Aimpoint with John Graham.
This is Golf Smarter.
Welcome back to Golf Smarter for members only, John.
Hello.
Thank you for sticking around. This is
absolutely
awesome. One of the last comments that you made, you were talking about how people, like, they need to know, you know, their launch angle and the spin rate, and then when they're on their approach, you know, for their drives, and then with their approach shots, they want to know, you know, GPS is not exacting enough. They have to do a range finder, like they can get that close. And yet, the part of your scorecard that allows you twice as many shots as anything else, they don't think it's that important.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think it's just a matter of, you know, what they're accustomed to. You know, a lot of golf, full swing, science and information and instruction, especially recently within the last, you know, 20 years or so, at least since video, has become much more structured and much more specific and detailed, and that just hasn't really happened with putting that much. And because putting isn't necessarily as difficult a skill in terms of, I don't usually hit putts that cause me penalty shots, you know, most people will tend to spend a little bit more time on the detail of that, because if they hit good shots toward the green, they feel like they've done well. If they hit good putts on the green, whether or not they go in, they still think they've done well. So their expectation of what good is, I think, a little bit different based on, you know, whatever their skill level is and their perception. I mean, the difference between the worst putter ever and the best putter ever is a much smaller difference than the best striker of the ball and the worst striker of the ball. I mean, the worst putter is not going to have 50 shots of putting more than the best putter, but certainly on ball striking they will. So there's, you know, I can kind of understand some of that, difference in least time of what they want to focus on. But when it comes down to making a living at the game, certainly they're going to have to do both very well, and they can't ignore one of them.
Is Aimpoint difficult for the average golfer? I mean, the people who aren't making a living at the game?
Is it difficult to do, understand, or learn? Which one do you think?
Yes. you know, let's start with learn and then do.
I'm certainly biased. I mean, I learned it and started doing it very, very quickly, and it made perfect sense, was very logical to me. Certain other people have a more difficult time with a three-dimensional perception than others. Mm. And the ones that struggle thinking of things in 3D, will initially have a little bit of a difficult time picturing what we're doing until we actually start doing it. You know, it's the fundamental class that I spend most of my time teaching is a 2.5-hour class, and more than half of it is actually doing putting and reading the ground, reading the green. And the first part of it is, you know, it's fair to say, is fairly information focused. And for a lot of people, they'll not really be sure that they're getting it until we actually start doing it. And then once we start doing it, then everything starts to make much more sense. Because most of the things that we talk about don't necessarily relate to the ball or the hole. It's relate to just the ground itself. And they're not used to dealing with just the ground. They're used to dealing with their ball and the hole and how do I get the two together. Well, we spent an hour or so teaching them that those two things don't necessarily matter just yet. Let's figure out what the ground is doing. Let's figure out how steep the ground is. Let's figure out some of these other things. And then based on that, okay, here's your ball, here's your hole, here's what it will do. And until they start putting all the pieces together, for some people it's a little bit difficult to perceive how they kind of fit together. I've been teaching it for about 4 years. And the way that we teach it, the version that we teach it now, is the sixth version of since I started doing it. So when I started doing it 4 years ago, the way that we used to teach it has significantly changed, and the way that we teach it now, in an attempt to make it much more understandable, much more easy, much faster, a whole bunch of these other things that people were looking for. You know, in the beginning, it was a little bit more I would say a little bit more technical. I mean, a lot more technical than it is now. And it would really appeal to the engineers and the doctors and the people that were used to dealing with that kind of idea. Over the course of the last 4 years, we've continually refined it and continually improved it to make it faster, easier to understand, easier to do, all of those things. And the way that we teach it now, I think, is about as simple as you can get so far that we've been able to figure out based on what variables you need to figure out. Here's what they are. Here's how you figure them out. Here's the answer. It doesn't get any more simple than that.
Yeah, it really doesn't. Here's I'm going to take a little side thing here. Can you describe and explain what STIMP is?
Yeah, sure. STIMP is a frictional component of the grass. The term STIMP comes from a gentleman whose name was STIMP, or maybe STIMP something. STIMP was part of his name. And he came up with this device that he called a STIMP meter, again, part of his name, that when placed at a certain height, it would roll down this ramp. And assuming the surface was perfectly flat, it would roll a certain distance. And whatever that distance is, let's say it's 6 feet or 10 feet, that number would represent the frictional component in the grass itself. So if the ball rolled shorter, that would be a green that had a lot more friction in it. The ball didn't travel very far, what would typically be called a slower green. If the ball rolled much, much further, that would be a grass with a lot less friction on it, or shorter grass, or however you want to describe it, and that would be called a faster green. So it's just the frictional component of the grass itself, its resistance to roll, if you want to picture it that way.
When we're on the practice putting green before a round, how much credibility should we give that practice green as to what we're going to be taking out to our round and what the practice green does versus what's going to be happening on the greens?
Well, generally speaking, the folks that work in the maintenance area of a golf course will tend to mow the greens with the same machine, or at least they won't specifically change the mower blade for one green versus another, because that's an incredible amount of extra work to do. So assuming that the greens were built around the same time, they'll be nearly identical. Now, if it was a really old course and the putting green didn't fit in the original design and they built it later, maybe they could be different. But the superintendent, the maintenance crew, usually try to make them as close together as possible to make the experience match. Certainly there have been occasions where they haven't matched, or you might have a green that will be a different stimp in the morning than in the afternoon, then again in the evening, which is depending on wind or rain or other environmental factors. That's, certainly something that does occur, but relative to the actual green and the putting green, generally they tend to be same just because it's a lot easier on the crew to make them the same than to make them different.
You mentioned wind and rain, and I can completely understand when a ball's in flight how the wind will have an impact on it, but how much impact can a wind have on a putt? Multiple questions I'm going to throw out here, and I apologize because I don't like doing that, but how long does a putt, generally is, a longer putt's going to have, there's going to be more impact from the wind, and how much wind, what kind of wind speed are we talking about that's going to have an impact on a putt?
Yeah, great questions. So the first one being, how much effect does wind have? The wind is fast enough at ground level, it has a major impact, a major, major impact. And certainly as the ball is rolling for longer distance and longer time, assuming a consistent wind amount and direction, it'll have more of an impact just because of the amount of time it's affecting the ball. The third one being how much. I can't remember exactly what the number is. I know Mark's told it to me a few times. I can't remember if it's 25.
Dude, the whole thing is about numbers. I mean,
yeah, I know. It's such a hard thing to measure because wind is not a constant force.
Sure.
And the wind that we feel at eye level versus treetop level versus ground level is also different.
Mm.
So trying to actually measure what the actual wind that's hitting the ball is relative to our head, they're not going to be the same. So we're trying to constantly make an estimation, based on what we're dealing with. One rule of thumb that we've been using that works pretty well, if you're approaching the green and the wind is strong enough to get the bottom of the actual flag that's on the flag stick horizontal, the wind at ground level will be moving the ball.
Hmm.
So if there's any droop in the flag, this is rule of thumb. This is not science. This is just an idea that we've been working with to kind of help people. That if the flag starts to get horizontal, the bottom of it, the wind at ground level will be moving the ball. Now,
the bottom of the flag.
The bottom of the actual flag, right.
Oh, that's really an excellent point. I never even thought of that. Look, you know, it's like, oh, good. Okay, you know, like when you're on your approach shot, you're looking for the flag so you know where you're headed, but never thought of, you know, and you obviously looking at the flag and the treetops on your ball flight, but
right.
Looking at that flag as you're approaching the green as what kind of impact it's going to have on your putt. I've never considered that.
Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, if for a normal putt that's, you know, from, let's say, directly across the slope, on a slope that's not very steep, we'll call average, which we would say is about a 2% slope, a fairly average slope amount. If the wind is going, you know, directly across the path of the putt, and it's that minimum distance that's going to start moving the ball for a green that's a stimp of, let's say, 10, it'll actually make the ball break the opposite way.
Wow.
I mean, it's a major, major fact. It's a much greater impact than grain ever thought it wanted to have, assuming that it's fast enough. But when it's fast enough, it has a dramatic impact. But it's really hard to predict because it's not usually a constant force. We don't really know exactly how windy it is. But it'll certainly affect your chips. They'll roll out, like a downwind chip will roll out much more. You know, downwind putts have to hit them a lot softer because the wind will do the rest. I mean, it'll do a number on it.
How, now let's get back to utilizing aim point and determining the break amount.
Right. So to get an actual break amount, you know, that we have to start, at least for the simplest of putts, we have to start with the assumption that the slope between the ball and the hole is the same. Now, that may only apply to a certain number of putts that a person runs across during a day, but we in the initial class, we start with that assumption. Now, we can teach people how to predict break on all of them, the ones with changing slopes and double breaks and all that, but we start with the general assumption of just a flat, tilted surface. And we go through the process of teaching them, okay, here's how you figure out what the angle is. If you can figure out where the fall line is between the ball and the hole, you know, based on where that is, where is my ball relative to that? So that's the one of our steps. The next one would be, okay, based on how we either perceive slope, either by sight or, again, by feel. We tend to do more feel-based things. If you picture someone standing on a slope, if it had no slope, their shin and foot would be about a 90-degree angle or so. And as the slope gets steeper, that angle between their ankle gets less. So we don't necessarily use an ankle or an angle reference of how my shin and my foot relate to each other, but based on how those two are coming together, we'll feel pressure in different places in the foot, whether it be more even or more toward the heel or more toward the toe, all depending on what type of slope that we're dealing with. We start to acquire a feel, an actual quantifiable feel for this feeling feels like this slope is this amount, and then we measure it and see how we do when we're practicing. So we actually start to train a feel-based event for how steep the ground actually is. And then, you know, we need to figure out our distance from the hole. Again, we can do that by sight, or if we want to pace it off, we can do that too. And then now based on those things, we look up the expected break amount based on those inputs in the aim chart that we provide during the class, and then we hit it and see what happens. And based on what occurs, we say, okay, well, you know, did the ball start online? Did it go the distance that we're recommending for these numbers? If it did both of those things and it didn't go in, then we can go back and measure each of the pieces that we just determined, see which ones we got right, which ones we got wrong, and then if any change is needed, we make that change and then readjust the answer. And it was that reason, the ability to figure out why I got something wrong, that I got involved and why I enjoy teaching it. I'll be more than happy to win a class to purposely do one wrong, because everybody wants to see it break down. And then to go back and say, okay, well, clearly what I did here was wrong. Let's go back and measure it all, see what I got wrong, relook up the expected break amount, hit it again, and then watch it go in. And then they're like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. So even though you can do it wrong, you can figure out why you got it wrong. There's no more, you know, looking at your coach and you hit one that goes way to the right slice, and you're like, well, that felt just like my last swing. Why did it go to the right? Mm-hmm. And there could be, you know, some amount of answers to that. And with putting, there never has been an answer. Why didn't it do that? Or, you know, was it the Indio, you know, Valley of Indio, or was it the Vegas Strip, or was it the mountains, or the Rays Creek, or the water, or downtown Phoenix, or whatever? A whole bunch of myths that have been kind of generated to kind of help explain what they didn't measure before, to help them predict what the ball was going to do. We can say, well, this is why it did this. We can go out and figure it out, and just measure it all and figure it out. And that's really why I got involved. But it's simply those skills, actual skill development that the golfer has to do. Can I determine what direction the ground is going? Based on that, can I determine where my ball is relative to that? Can I determine how steep the ground is between the ball and the hole? And then how far away? That's obviously the most intuitive one. And then based on those things and a certain stimp amount, we just look up the answer and try to hit it, see if we can do it.
That's always the case. Let's see if we can do it.
Yeah.
Do you have any preference when you're working with people on the type of grip that they have, whether they use an anchored putter, our favorite topic these days, an anchored putter, you know, if they have a fat grip, or where their hands are, or the type, if they're using a blade or a mallet, does any of that have any effect on how we use aim point?
No. It certainly has an effect on their ability to do the other skills, which are starting it online and hitting it at a speed that they're trying to hit it at. Relative to what we do, which is, you know, just one small little niche of, can we choose an appropriate target? Their ability to hold a putter, you know, with their feet doesn't really matter, as, you know, whether they hold it in their hands or belly putters or long putters. Choosing the target is completely separate from all of that. Now, if a player comes to us and says, okay, this is great, but I can't hit any of my putts where this target is, what good does this do me? Well, you know, that's a whole nother topic that, you know, a putting instructor or their normal coach or one of us will get into. But most of the time that we're spending teaching is initially just on the targeting piece, choosing the right target.
So you're making a basic assumption that they're going to get the ball on the proper line from the start.
Well, we're not necessarily making that assumption, but we're telling them that if they do, this is what will happen. And then if they don't, then their normal teacher should say, okay, it's not that you're actually choosing it's not that you're actually putting it poorly, but you've been chosen the wrong target all along. Or it's not that you're choosing the right target and you're hitting it poorly. Now they can actually define when they miss, did I hit the putt online or not? Did I choose the right target or not? And they can much more clearly define what skills are lacking based on that. If we never know if the target's right or not, how do we ever know if we hit a good putt? Mm-hmm. So once you know that we can prove that the target is correct, now you can see, okay, did this player actually start it there, yes or no? Did the player hit it the appropriate speed, yes or no? And they can actually start to specifically see where practice relative to their putting skills is. Is it, okay, I do have a good stroke, but I've been choosing the wrong target, because now with the right target I make a lot more? Or, you know, do I need to work on my speed, because one time I hit it a foot short, and the next time I hit it 5 feet long, but the ball starts online okay, or is the ball never starting online? In either case, it gives them much more direction as to where to focus their time.
Hmm. I find this so interesting. How long did it take for you, once you started studying aimpoint, to see an impact on your score, on your putting results?
Gosh, that's a good question. I was a pretty good putter before this, And this really more kind of helped me understand why I was a good putter. You know, I would play in a scramble with my buddies or even a pro scramble or whatever, where you actually all get to kind of choose the line from the same place. And it kind of helped explain why my lines were very different than a lot of other people's lines. But I would say, you know, I would tend to be a little bit more on the obsessive side of something that I really am involved in. So I would spend the majority of my practice time when I first learned it with no ball, no putter, nothing, just going out onto the green and practicing the actual skills of reading the ground. You know, can I determine what direction the ground is going? I think it's this way. Measure it. See how I did.
Yeah. How can you do that without a ball?
Absolutely. I don't need a ball to know which way the ground's going. I just walk right out there and say, okay, I think this is uphill. I actually measure the ground itself. Is this uphill? Yes or no? And then move on. Or I'll go to another spot of the ground and say, I think this is uphill and I think it's tilted on a 2% grade. Measure them both. See how I did.
When you say measure them both, and what do you use to do that?
There's a couple different devices that I've used over the years. I first started with a device called a Breakmaster, which is a little gray box about the size of a cup on the green. And at the time, they were a little bit more reasonably priced than they are now. They're roughly over $125 or so now. But they will give you you just kind of place it on the ground, and it will point in the direction of downhill. And it will then also give you an amount of how steep the ground is in an angle in degrees. So I would originally start with that, where I would just go stand on the ground, face where I think was uphill, put the little device right between my feet, and if it pointed at me, well, I had the direction of the ground right. Another device that I've used are similar ones that I would have on my phone, which are significantly cheaper, you know, for like a dollar. And then I would just put my phone on the ground, and that would do the same thing. Another device that we use is an actual level that you get at the hardware store that will measure the ground that way. And I tend to use that one a little bit more often because it's a little bit longer, which I think kind of evens out some of the inconsistencies in the turf, gives me a little bit more appropriate answer. But it's just actually practicing the skills of, can I figure out what direction is the ground and how steep is it? And so it took me about a month, I would say, to do that to a level that I thought was accurate enough before I went out and actually tried it on the course. I don't generally play all that often anyway, so it was easy for me to not play for a while and just practice.
Mm-hmm. You're a golf instructor. Golf instructors don't get to play very often.
No. And I'm,
especially
and I'm a golf instructor with four kids under 10, so I play even less than most people.
You're lucky you're a golf instructor. That would have been gone from your life. You bring up the word golf, your wife would be going, no, exactly. I don't think so. But I'm working.
Easier for me to practice for a little while first before I actually started using it. And I think that's actually was a big benefit. I think it's more difficult to go out on the course and try to use it without having a real good foundation of the accuracy of your skill set. So I would certainly recommend that if, you know, the people that are learning it that are really, really into it, you know, to spend a good amount of time working on the slope direction and amount piece and continually do it. I continually do it. Like every class that I teach, before I go to teach it, I have to set up the green and kind of measure some things. And I'll walk out on the green and continually test myself because I'm looking for a specific numbers, so specific places that will measure a certain amount, and I'll go walk over to them and say, okay, I think this is the one I'm looking for, measure it and see how I did. And I'm constantly doing that process while I'm getting ready for the class and while I'm teaching and things of that nature, so that when I go play, it's just part of what I do.
Mm-hmm. But you said you started out as a good putter. Did this make you a great putter?
I make a lot. I'm not going to lie to you. I don't know what a great putter is. You know, I don't play enough to be what I would consider a great putter.
Because of touch.
Yeah, I mean, for the amount that I play, I'm a good putter.
And will a poor putter, somebody who just is, you know, will three putt 10 times in a round or more, is this going to have an impact on their scoring in a relevant amount of time?
Yeah, for certainly. I mean, the first thing that they're going to generally notice, and this at least has been in my experience teaching it, is that the number of three putts usually decreases first above everything else. Mainly because they've chosen a target that is more appropriate than maybe what they've chosen before. And the thing that most people don't necessarily equate with the target is the target has kind of a speed assumption based in it. You know, if I've got some putt that's, let's say, going to break 3 or 4 feet, it's a, you know, or what we would call a, you know, a fast downhiller or something like that. If I, instead of choosing a 4 foot aim, I choose a 1 foot aim, the speed difference I would have to hit those two to have any chance of making them is so dramatically different that if I make a mistake with the one that I aimed way too close and I miss, now I'm also 6 feet by the hole. Where if I choose a line that's significantly higher, most people automatically start to say, well, gosh, I've got to hit this so soft now because it needs to break that much. They've kind of learned intrinsically that that relationship exists, you know, that more break usually equals slower. And they'll start to get their misses much closer so that they can two putt first. In terms of just some general relationships and, again, kind of rules of thumbs, a little bit of math, if a player underreads a putt by a foot but still has the appropriate speed that would put it about a foot past the hole, they're going to miss the hole by 2 feet. If they overread it by a foot, again with the appropriate speed, they miss the hole by 6 inches. So if they make a mistake that's higher than their normal mistake, their misses are going to be significantly closer.
I'm going to stop you and ask you to define under and over on that.
So let's say the actual break for this particular putt is a 2 foot break, or at least a 2 foot aim would be a better way to say it. And the golfer aims, instead of at 2 feet, they aim it at 1 foot. So they've underread the break by a foot.
Okay.
If they hit that putt and start it right at a foot out, they're going to miss the hole 2 feet low. If instead of choosing the correct aim, which was 2 feet, and instead they aim 3 feet out, so now they've overread it by a foot. If they hit the same putt with the same speed, they only miss the hole by 6 inches.
So you always want to overread just a touch.
If you're going to make a mistake, yeah.
If you're going to make a mistake. Right. And what is it that you see? Is there a consistent element that you notice for those folks who do three putt a lot? Is there something that you go like, yeah, oh, I'm finding this correlation between all these bad putters?
Yeah, generally, most people three putt because their touch is no good, because their speed is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Their perception of...
Is that a depth perception thing?
I don't believe so.
No, it's just touch. It's just practice.
Yeah, I don't even know if it's just practice, but it's if they have the general idea in their head that downhill putts are faster, they're already right off the bat in big trouble. If I said to someone, okay, let's say from here, I want this putt to roll 5 seconds... or I want this putt to roll 3 seconds, their perception of the amount of effort required to do that immediately changes. If I don't give them any information at all and just say I want this ball to go to the hole, they've got to now make some kind of internal adjustment based on their previous experience to say, okay, well, this amount of steepness looks like this. It feels like I'm going to hit it this hard. There's a whole lot more guessing involved, if you will. Then if I was to say to someone, okay, if we could do this too, if we wanted to teach touch a little bit, we have the amount of time each putt should roll. So as an idea to say to someone, okay, I want you to hit two putts, one that rolls 3 seconds and one that rolls five, immediately they're going to do something different. And they may not get it right, but they're going to hit the 5 second one differently than they're going to hit the 3 second one.
I'm just flabbergasted. Does anybody ever consider the length of time in their putt? I mean, I've got a 20-foot putt here. I've got a 10-foot putt here. But it's like you never say, I've got a 4-second putt here, do you? And is that a value to do that?
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out. We're trying to figure out if there's better ways to teach touch than just distance or just a speed equivalent. Uh-huh. Is time an option for learning to control touch? We're just on the kind of on the fairly early beginnings of at least testing that. So we don't really have a good answer as to whether or not it's all that useful. But as a general concept, I think it's very, very useful. to try and get people to understand that downhill putts should take more time than uphill putts. Things of that nature should, you know, everyone should know that.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not a 20-foot putt takes 5 and a 10-foot putt takes 3, we're still trying to figure out how much value that has. And it may turn out to be, you know, individually, some people really benefit from it. Other people just don't get it. It could go either way. We're like I said, we're just kind of getting started with that.
Interesting. Any courses that you've tested, been to, taught on that you just cannot figure out the breaks and the putts?
No.
Really?
There's only so many things that can happen. I mean, there's a certain amount of steepness that the ground will generally have. You know, aside from tiers and large areas, there's generally going to be a minimum amount to get water to move off of it. So we'll start with that assumption right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
There's very few actually flat areas because the water will sit and
puddle
and appeal.
Yeah.
And you know, the slope direction, you know, can only be a certain way. Once you understand really what you're looking for, the only part of the green that's going to affect the ball is the part the ball rolls on and actually touches. So all the rest of it is completely ignorable. You know, where the mountains are, where the high points on the green are, all of that stuff is completely ignorable if the ball is not going to actually touch it. You know, I need to figure out what the ground's doing where the ball is actually rolling. And you know, once you learn how to do it and what you're looking for or feeling for, it's, you know, it's very hard to fool a person's balance. You know, except maybe, you know, like late Friday night or late Saturday night after a couple drinks, you know, their balance isn't so good. Aside from that, very few people fall down when they walk. So their body is constantly making this adjustment every single step that it takes. That's kind of usually running in the background. And we're trying to take that idea, that sensation, and kind of pull it to the forefront and say, you know, this foot stepped differently than this one. Did it go up? Did it go down? Did you feel left or right? Hmm. All of these sensations are learnable and teachable and then applicable.
Yep. Now, I know that Mark Sweeney had talked about the palms down in La Quinta as being the toughest greens he'd ever dealt with, because I was down at the Palms recently and met JD over there, and he and Dr. Craig Farnsworth, who also teaches Aimpoint, teaches at that course, and JD was telling me that Mark said that this is the, you know, because there's no putt over 10 feet that doesn't have a double break.
Yeah. There's certainly greens that are harder to read than others, at least in terms of the exact amount. But if you get the direction of the break wrong, I mean, that's a mistake I haven't made in years now. That you think it's going to go right, it actually goes the other way. That whole idea should go away, almost exclusively.
Well, that's huge in itself.
Yeah, for a lot of people.
Yeah,
But, you know, knowing that it was going to go 4 inches versus 8 or whatever, that's, you know, we'll all make those mistakes. And especially, you know, the hardest putts to read, and this is the same as it always has been, are the ones that are the flattest looking, flattest feeling, flattest actual surfaces, that it's hard to perceive the fall line and the slope amount because they tend to be flat, or ones that are a little bit kind of crown is what we call it. It's kind of like a high spot that runs off to a lows. So, you know, very subtle crowns, or, you know, constantly changing undulations, which you might see much more over in Europe than you do here. Again, it's all doable. It's just, you know, how accurately can I do it in the amount of time necessary to still play golf with people that will enjoy it. You know, if it takes you more than 20 seconds to read a straightforward putt, you know, you're doing it incorrectly.
Mm-hmm.
More putts take more time as they're more challenging, but
I think that's just an amazing thing to think about. The hardest putts to read are the flat ones.
Yeah.
That's really, really interesting.
Right. The hardest putts to make are the steeper ones, but the hardest ones to read right.
Ah.
I mean, the steeper sloped ones are the ones that are downhill that are significantly, they're much more sensitive to error in terms of our speed or direction. So they're much, much more difficult to make. But I can, I mean, if you think about it in terms of the variance between the target that would be okay and the one that's not, you know, a steeper putt that has an incredible amount of break is going to be very sensitive to the speed that you hit it, the amount of time that it rolls for, mm-hmm. as to when and how much the break occurs. So that actual two target is very, very small. A flatter putt, because there's not going to be too much break in general anyways, the margin for error in my skills is a little bit greater, but getting an exact number of accuracy is harder because it's hard to perceive exactly where I am. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know that Aimpoint offers, once you have your lessons, you've taken the class and been certified as an Aimpoint student, they have an iPhone app,
yep. right,
that
yep.
people can use, but they should not. Now, we really want to warn people, at least what Mark was telling me, don't get the app unless you've been taught.
Yeah, it won't make much sense.
Right. Is it helpful? Do you find it helpful for a lot of people?
The app is helpful after you know what you're looking at.
Yeah, exactly.
It's basically just a big digital blown up version of the chart. So it has many more answers that are kind of filled in where you don't have to extrapolate so much.
And don't get a bubble level on your smartphone and lay that out on the green.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that kind of could screw you up too. Or would it? Wait, I mean, if you were like, hang on a second, I can tell you how steep it is. Let me just take out my phone here and lay it down. It's at about 4 degrees there.
It would certainly give you some information. Whether or not you know what to do with it is the whole story. How to translate that into something useful is a whole other deal.
How can people get in touch with you if they want to have you teach them? Do you do individual or do you mostly do clinics?
I do both. I'll be in Phoenix next weekend doing some individual and some group. So depending on
we say next weekend, but as we're recording the beginning of March, and this is a podcast and somebody's now listening to it in July, it doesn't help them.
Yes. So the weekend of March, 10th and 11th, that's coming up here. But anyway, yes, I do teach individuals and groups. The easiest way to reach me is through email at john@johngrahamgolf.com. You can also tweet me. I'm a Twitter addict.
Really?
I've got real problems.
You aren't
with
familiar
that.
With podcasts, but you're all over Twitter.
I'm all over Twitter. I am all over it. I've got like 50,000 tweets.
Really? What do you use it for? For putting information out or for absorbing information?
I use it in every way that is imaginable. I mainly use it to generate business, to be honest.
Really?
I would say 95% of every clinic I've ever taught has come from a contact through Twitter.
That's very interesting.
So I use it as, you know, both a content providing element so that will hopefully generate interest and then people will contact me and say, hey, that's pretty neat. I want to learn about it more, and then set up a class, something of that nature. For me, it's replaced news. I mean, I get information significantly faster. This is a funny story. I remember I was actually on my computer the night that Tiger Woods had his incident where he hit the fire hydrant.
Right.
And within 20 minutes of somebody tweeting about that, someone had already said, yeah, Ellen came out, smashed the thing with an iron, and he ran out the door and hit the fire hydrant. I mean, someone in the neighborhood just told the whole story before it even hit the television. Mm. It was really, really interesting. I mean, you hear about earthquakes the second they happen. It's bizarre. It's a completely different level of news that is, you know, instantaneous and unedited, which certainly has dangers in its own right.
Sure. I have older children, but they've said, you know, who are very tech savvy, and they've said, why do you read a newspaper? It's yesterday's news, you know? And if something is that important, it's going to find me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Oh, I find that so interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, so what is your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is John Graham Golf. Same thing on Facebook. You can find me there. John Graham Golf, YouTube, John Graham Golf. There's a pattern developing there.
Yes, there is. And what do you have on YouTube?
I have a couple of videos of Aimpoint of different different things that we cover. I also have some videos on some full swing information about some impact physics, about deep plane, things like that. Most of my videos tend to be more either visual illusions or optical things like that, or factually based information that again I prefer things that I can prove. Mm-hmm. And golf doesn't really have a lot of those things in it. So I seek out which ones there are, and then I'm happy to share what I can find.
Well, do me a favor. Why don't you email me links to two of your favorite Aimpoint YouTube videos, and I will put those on our blog. Since we're doing two episodes, I'll associate one with each episode, and I'll put them on the Golf Smarter blog in the show notes, and that so people can take a peek at that and go find more of your stuff. We'll definitely feature that as well. Absolutely.
Oh, sounds great. Thank you. I'll be happy to.
Oh yeah, great. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much for your time, and I wish you all the luck of the world, because you're going to need to be very busy. You have four kids.
Yeah. Yes,
you got to make a lot of money. How many girls you got?
I'm sorry?
How many daughters do you have?
Just one. I have three older boys and a baby girl.
Oh, the princess.
Yes.
I just recently saw a teenage girl, I guess, driving down in a convertible Volkswagen. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that came to my mind was, but daddy, I want a convertible. Okay, princess, no problem. You're stuck, man. And you got to put all the boys through college, and then you got to have a wedding. Oh, man, you get back to work. What are you doing sitting at home?
Exactly.
Where are you based? What part of the country?
I am in Rochester, New York.
Okay. So, yeah, you've got to get to a place where you can do 12 months a year worth of worth of teaching.
Yes,
or you travel a lot. Yeah. Oh, man. Well, this has been great. Thank you very much. Best of luck to you. And we'll stay in touch. And hopefully, if anybody has any questions, they'll email me. I can send it right over to you. But you already gave your email address.
Yes, thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks again for having me.
Thank you to new Golf Smarter member Roger Swanson of Houston, Texas, and returning member Sharon Friedman. Chag Sameach, Freddy. An Israeli who has transplanted to London and became just as obsessed with golf as the rest of his new countrymen. And we've actually played together once when he was in the San Francisco area on business. Gave me a call. Fred, you want to play golf? Absolutely. These two Golf Smarter members are each going to receive a free 30-count bottle of Alpha Brain by Onnit Labs. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions about Golf Smarter or me, I don't care. Please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.